welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, and this hour, true history from three programs, later on from the Cavalcade of America and Adventures in Research. But first, it's Captains of Industry, with the story of Henry Flagler, from December 26, 1937.
The story of Henry Morrison Flagler. Flagler was born in 1830 in poverty. He was forced to shift for himself, clerked in a store, slept under the counter, and caught his education on the wing. Bold as a lion in business, sensitive and silent in personal relations, he was a born leader, pious, secretive, and a good listener. An uncanny ability to draw men out and pump them dry. Flagler once said to John D. Rockefeller,
"John, a friendship founded on business is a whole lot better than a business founded on friendship."
To Flagler, does John D. Rockefeller credit the rapid erection of the greatest monopoly that is the wonder of statisticians and economists the world over? Yet, this man was a failure at everything he tried until he was past 37. At 14, his father hired him out.
"Here's the store, my son. Mr. Howe, the proprietor, is a good Christian man. He will see that you walk in the way of the Lord. You can expect no more aid from me. You're 14 and should be self-supporting."
"I will try, Father. How much money am I to receive?"
"You'll be paid what you're worth."
"Well, I would like to know if it's enough for me to support myself."
"Read your Bible, lad. It will do you well to read it more often. What does the great teacher say? Take no thought for your life, what ye shall eat or what ye shall drink, nor yet for your body what ye shall put on. Is not life more than meat, and the body than raiment?"
"I will do my best, Father."
"Is this the lad, Reverend Flagler?"
"It is, Mr. Howe. You will find him obedient and God-fearing. See that he earns what you pay him. And should it be more than you think is well for him to handle, you may send it to me. I will write you from time to time."
"He will earn every cent I pay him, I promise you that."
"That will be well. And now I must say goodbye, as I'm on my way west to preach to the heathens."
"Goodbye, Reverend. I hope the Lord is always with you."
"Thank you, Mr. Howe."
"Now, Henry, your duties will be to rise at 5:30. Sweep the store. Mr. Pettigill, the other clerk, will be here at 7:30. Then you can have your breakfast. In the winter, you will get up 1 hour earlier to have the fires started."
"Yes, sir, I understand."
"I shall pay you $5 a month in currency."
"Oh, I thank you, sir."
"And I will charge you $5 a month for your keep."
"Oh, but, sir, if I may say it, I'll pay out everything I make for my keep, and that way I won't be able to save a thing."
"Ah, want to save? Good. I like to encourage thrift, and I'll help you. You can make a bed under one of the counters, and I will allow you $1 a month off for that."
That was the start of Henry's saving. He saved the dollar each month. While working in the store, he learned that there was a medium of exchange that was more valuable than money. This was salt. At 18, with a friend, he started a salt refinery. They were doing well when a rival concern decided to force them to sell. The partners were in their office talking to the agent of the salt company.
"I've told you, gentlemen, that we will invoice and pay you dollar for your plant."
"No, but that's not right, sir. We're making a profit and continue to do so if your firm will stop underselling us."
"Young man, if you don't take our offer, we will force you to the wall."
"No, but let us sell the salt we've refined, then we'll be glad to sell our plant to you. In that way, we'll have a fair return for our work."
"My dear boy, that would be impossible. It would take you a year to sell all that salt, and in the meantime, you might undersell us."
"No, but, sir, you're advancing the price of salt 300%. People won't pay it."
"They'll pay our price or go without."
"No, but your tactics are nothing less than robbery. You admit that you're going to rob the public and us, too."
"Well, looks like we'd better accept their offer, Henry."
"If only they offer us enough to pay our obligations, we'll be stony broke."
"Oh, true, but we'll be free of debt."
"Oh, it's robbery, that's what it is."
"Take it or leave it. We will undersell you until you do accept our terms. Good day."
The Ocean Salt Company forced them to sell and lose every penny they had invested in years of hard work. Flagler drifted into many lines of business until the year 1867. In that year, he joined the firm of Andrews and Rockefeller. In 1872, they changed the name to the Standard Oil Company of Ohio. Competition was very keen. Refineries were underselling each other. So in 1872, a meeting was called by the Standard Oil Company of Ohio of the four biggest competitors to meet at Cleveland. Mr. Rockefeller said,
"Gentlemen, this meeting is called to try and solve the problem now facing the oil industry. Mr. Flagler will tell you his ideas."
"Thank you, sir. Gentlemen, I will try to be as brief as possible. In the first place, we are all trying to undersell the other.
That's right, Henry.
Now, here is the plan. We will combine all our plants under one head that will dictate our selling policy and business conduct in general. I will suggest my partner, Mr. Rockefeller, for that place. You have in him a man of keen foresight and sound business judgment.
Would we run our plants just as usual?
Why, yes. We will form a parent company, and according to the invoice of their various plants, we will issue stock in the parent company. We will start our company with the ones gathered here today. Then I, personally, will try to induce all the independent companies to join our combine.
Splendid idea. Splendid. What do you think, Tom?
Excellent. It's a great idea.
Well, yeah, it's great idea.
And with this idea in mind, Henry Morris and Flagler visited the small refineries. Most of them saw the advantage and joined. Some fought. Among these was the firm of Jones and Claxon, who had left the salt industry for oil.
Mr. Jones, the men I represent own most of the refineries in the country, and I am here and there in your interest.
But, Mr. Flagler, we do not care to sell. We are making a handsome profit.
Mr. Jones, the railroads are going to raise the rates on shipping. That will curtail your profits.
Not enough to matter. No, we will not sell.
And then, will you gentlemen let us handle your refined product?
What's your proposition?
Well, sir, you will join the refineries that I represent. We will take over the management of each unit and issue stock in the parent company pro ratio of the money you have invested.
That would be like giving you our business.
No, not at all. You would retain your own business, your own name.
Yes,
your own...
but we would be dictated to by your firm.
Ah, by a parent firm, yes. But your profits would be greater.
This is just a scheme to rob the public, combining the refineries and then raising the price of oil.
Join our organization, gentlemen, or we'll force you to the wall.
What was that you said?
It's robbery. You're going to rob the public and rob us, too.
I am offering you a chance to save what you have accumulated. I am far more fair to you than you gentlemen were to me.
What do you mean? We've never had any dealings with you.
No, sir.
Oh, yes, you did. Many years ago. I was a partner in Brown and Flagler Salt Company, and you put us out of business without giving us a chance to save our investment. You really robbed my partner and myself of everything that we had. Now you cry when I come to you with a fair proposition. Well, gentlemen, I've changed my mind. You can't enter our organization.
Well, now, Mr.
We will audit your plant and pay you dollar for dollar.
But, sir...
We will use the practice you so ably taught me years ago.
Now, if you just...
We will undersell you until you accept our terms. Good day, sirs.
Jones and Claxon received better treatment from Henry Morris and Flagler than they had given him when they had the whip hand. During the close of the last century, Henry Morris and Flagler became greatly interested in the development of Florida. His first project was a railroad, but the settlers and squatters fought every move he made by destroying his property. His foremen were unable to cope with the situation, so Henry took a hand.
Listen. We've been shooting over your head so far, but I warn you, if you don't leave this property in 5 minutes, we're going to shoot to kill.
You hear me, mister. If you shoot one of us, we'll tear the whole caboodle of you limb from limb. Don't pay no attention to what's being said by this outlander, folks. Just keep ripping up the rain.
Yeah, you bet your...
Look it over yonder. The outlanders are getting help from outside there. Why, there's three big wagons are coming.
Come on, you fellas. We'll tip them wagons over.
Sure will, man. Come on.
Come on. Get out of them wagons. We're going to tip them over and set them afire.
Wait. Who's the leader here?
I am.
Then let me talk to you for just 1 minute. And then if you're not satisfied with what I have to say, you can do what you please with these wagons.
All right, monsieur, we'll listen. Have your say.
These three wagons contain food. I brought it out here so that we all could have a big picnic. Now, there's just one question I want to ask you. Just why are you so opposed to this railroad being built?
You tell him, Pete. Yes.
Tell him why we don't want this snorting contraption around here.
Well, old Granny Johnson said the noise of the cars would scare our cows so they wouldn't give no milk. She said she'd seen it happen before.
And just who is this Granny Johnson?
She's a wise woman. She knows everything.
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do, Pete. I'll make each one of you a present of a brand new cow the day that railroad's finished. I'll replace every cow that refuses to give milk on account of that railroad.
That sounds right fine, but how do you know you'll do what you say?
Well, when I get back to the city, you can all go with me. And, Pete, I'll buy the cows, turn them over to you to be delivered the day the railroad's finished.
Now, is that fair enough?
That sounds fair. What do you folks say?
You're the boss, Pete. What do you say goes?
You say you had grub in them wagons?
That's right.
Got enough men to cook this stuff?
I think we have.
You start your cooking and get that yellow-eared hound that you call a boss out here to show these folks how to put them tracks back.
What are you going to do?
We're going to fix up all the stuff we wrecked for you. Am I saying right, folks?
Well, we're starting, ain't we?
And Henry Morris and Flagler had welded another link in the chain of friendship and showing again that remarkable organizing ability. It was no wonder that John D. Rockefeller picked such a man to aid him in building the great Standard Oil Company. Henry Flagler was the proprietor of some 600 miles of railroad in Florida and the Ponce de Leon and Alcazar hotels at St. Augustine. As builder and owner resident, he did much to make St. Augustine the popular winter resort that it is today. In 1911, Mr. Flagler retired from the Standard Oil Company. 2 years later, May 20th, 1913, he died, leaving an estate estimated at $60 million. Little has been written of this silent man, but he deserves a niche in the Hall of Fame, for he is one of the outstanding characters of this century. Henry Morrison Flagler, Captain of Industry.
Captains of Industry, on Tuned to Yesterday, that episode heard the day after Christmas 1937. We move on now with a broadcast of Adventures in Research from the mid-1940s, this episode called The King of Ice.
Adventures in Research. We do take a lot of things for granted. Water, air, earth, sun, ice. Well now, ice. Perhaps you never heard of the man who invented ice. This is Paul Shannon bringing you another transcribed story of science produced as a public service in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. And today telling you the story of the Ice King, as he liked to be called. And he also liked to think he invented ice. This notion seemed absurd to the New Englanders at the dawn of the 19th century. Invent ice? With lakes, rivers, and streams frozen over? When part of any winter's work was sawing out blocks of the solid stuff.
Come on, Tom. Let's keep moving. Gosh, it's cold.
Well, ain't that enough? How much of the consigned stuff does Martha need, anyhow?
Oh, just enough to store in the cellar. Now, one more block ought to do it. Heave to!
While such scenes were common in the northernmost states, a young chap named Frederick Tudor of Boston found the winter months more pleasant on a ship headed for the West Indies.
Ah, there, Tudor. Another fine day for sailing. Ocean smooth as glass, eh?
Indeed. Oh, it's like a different world. When I think of the poor souls up in Boston and New England. Fetch more wood, Frederick. Get out the snow shovel, Frederick. Heat the bricks for the bed, Frederick. Oh, this is the life. Warm sun, no winter clothes.
For a young chap, you've done quite well for yourself, Tudor. Don't mind my asking, but just what do you do the rest of the year?
Oh, work in a Boston shipping firm. Started when I was 13. Oh, been there for 8 years. 8 years of cold winters and ice and snow.
Well, see, you've left that far behind. Wait till you see the West Indies. The captain says we'll be putting into port this afternoon about sundown.
Good.
Care to debark and see the place, Tudor?
Fine.
Sure is warm, isn't it? I've been doing little else but mop my brow. I don't mind it being warm, but a man can get baked in this climate, too, you know.
Yes, but I love it. Oh, how about joining me in some ginger tea? That should cool you off.
Cool you off? Man, you're mad. It's warm
well,
as...
it doesn't have to be. Up home in the summers, we chip some ice from the ice cellar and...
Ice? We left that back there, boy. Ice. These people never saw ice, never heard of it, and wouldn't believe it if you showed it to them.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot. Imagine living all your life and not knowing what ice is.
Yeah, I think I'll go below deck. That sun will have me baked to a crisp.
Next time I come back, I'll have to bring my own ice with me.
Back in his native Boston, young Tudor approached his father with a peculiar request.
Dad, you know that pond you own up in Saugus?
Uh-huh. What about it?
Well, I wondered if I might be able to use it.
Use it? Well, it's pretty well fished out. Just a few miles out of Boston. Yeah, and the city is growing, so...
I don't want it for fishing. I want the ice.
Yeah, in a few years... You want the what?
The ice. When it freezes over this winter.
Why, I don't see why not. Welcome to it, son. You're going to build another ice cellar? Go right ahead, lad. Take all of it you want.
Thank you, Dad.
Frederick, you're welcome to it, of course. Take all the ice in the pond. But what do you intend to do with it? Not that it's any of my business, of course, but then...
Well, thanks again, Dan.
Frederick, as I say, it's none of my affair. The ice is there for the taking. What you want with it is your own concern.
Well, of course.
I mean... Well, hang it, son. What are you going to do with a whole pond full of ice? That is... Well, now, mind you, I know you have a good reason for it, I'm sure, but then...
Well, I do, Dad. I'm going to take the ice down to the West Indies.
I see. Well, I knew you'd have a sound, sensible, sane... You what?
Yes, Frederick Tudor was going to bring ice to the equator. With hardly enough cash to pay for cutting the ice, he managed to charter a ship, and in the winter of 1805... sent two helpers down to the port of Saint-Pierre in Martinique to prepare for the arrival. In March of 1806, Frederick Tudor arrived in Martinique on a ship whose hold was filled with 130 tons of ice packed in hay.
Excuse me, you speak English?
Oui, I speak English, little.
Have you seen a couple of Americans, a Mr. Armitage, a Mr. Westland?
Je ne sais pas.
Oh, a tall man, short man, my friends, supposed to meet me here. Meet me here. Ice. They talk of ice. In boat. Boat. Ice.
No.
Let me put it this way. American money?
American money. They be at Tivoli Garden. Yes, they spend, laugh, drink. We... they gone.
Tivoli Gardens?
Oui, Tivoli Garden. Over there, see? It say Tivoli.
Mm, thanks.
Merci, monsieur. Merci. Merci, monsieur.
Are you the proprietor?
Ah, oui, monsieur. Giovanni Tivoli. At your service, monsieur.
I'm looking for some countrymen of mine from the States. Okay. I understand they were here.
Ah, I look for them too. They leave Giovanni. They say... wish you, Giovanni. Goodbye, Giovanni.
Well,
pay you later, Giovanni. For 2 weeks, Giovanni, wait. I cannot afford to lose such money. They're your friend? You pay their bill, huh?
I'm afraid not. They left me holding the bag, too.
Ah. What bag?
I have a cargo aboard my ship in the harbor, and they were supposed to...
You bring in cargo from the States,
yes,
Monsieur?
And something has to be done quickly. With this sun beating down, in no time it'll all...
Oh, of course, sun no good for food, Monsieur. Sun spoil it soon.
Not spoil it, melt it.
Such funny words you use in States, Monsieur. We say food spoil, you say food melt?
Melt. But it isn't food, it's ice, and it's very...
I am sure, nice, very nice.
Not nice, ice, I-C-E, ice.
Oh, to be sure, monsieur, oui, ice, I-C-E, ice, n'est-ce pas?
Yes, ice.
Ice, oui. What is ice?
Well, it's the, well, when it freezes, you, well... water becomes...
Ah, water. You like less of water, monsieur. Of course. There you are, monsieur. Water. Complimente Tivoli Gardens.
Mm, A very nice establishment you have here.
Like in the States, no, monsieur. Just like in the States.
Well, sort of. Of course, in the States we have ice.
Tivoli Gardens, as good as States, monsieur. Nothing you have there that Giovanni does not have here.
Well, you lack just one thing. Eh? If you had that, then indeed your Tivoli Gardens would be as great as any American restaurant.
What do we not have? Giovanni has everything. Look, coffee, tea, a home-baked cake.
Mm-hmm, but where is your ice?
Ice?
Ice.
In States, monsieur. Every place has this ice.
Wouldn't dream of opening without it. Unheard of.
Tivoli Gardens, as good as any place. I, too, can have ice. You say you have a shipload of this ice in harbor, monsieur?
Oh, I do, but... I've already promised it to...
Promise, bah! I buy this ice. I pay double. You sell to me, eh?
Well, you're a hard businessman, Giovanni. all right, I'll sell you the ice.
Good, monsieur. One question, monsieur. Now I have the ice, what do I do with it?
Why, you can make ice cream with it.
Oh, ice cream, oui, of course, ice cream. what is this ice cream?
You never heard of ice cream?
Never, monsieur.
Well, you will, Giovanni, and all Martinique will.
Huh?
You have some milk,
oui.
Sugar,
oui.
Flavorings?
Oui.
Here, take my coat. I'll start in making some ice cream right now, and by tomorrow, Tivoli Gardens will be the talk of Martinique.
On the first night, Tivoli Gardens sold more than $300 worth of ice cream, and the customers crowded the place. The local newspaper hailed the event.
This remarkable epoch in the history of luxury and enterprise began March 6, 1806, when ice creams were eaten for the first time in the settlement of the country lying just 14 degrees north of the equator.
And though the bringing of ice to Martinique might be hailed as a social success, financially, Tudor lost almost $3,500 due to the melting of the ice. But he tried it again, this time in 1815 in Havana, where startled natives saw the construction of a strange building.
Mamma mia, he say it is an ice house.
An ice house it was, with double partitions and dead space between the walls and heavy plank flooring. In the floor, gutters were embedded like eaves spouts, which caught the melted ice and conveyed it to a barrel outside. At the barrel, Frederick Tudor stood with a watch in his hand.
Hour's up. Runoff amounts to 56 pounds. Now, that's too much. We'll need more hay to cover the ice. Better. 33 pounds in an hour. But not good enough. We'll bank earth around the building and try that. 18 pounds. We can't do much better than that.
But Tudor was still not completely satisfied. His shipments increased. His fleet enlarged. But what could he do to preserve the ice? Hay was not enough. He tried tan bark, chaff, wheat, pulverized cork, even coal dust. Until he hit upon another item of New England waste. Pine sawdust. With the help of that and new special tools, augers, tongs, picaroons, his ice exports jumped from 4,000 tons a year to 65,000 tons. He sent apples to the tropics, brought tropical fruits to the States, and was soon recognized as the ice king of the world. 4 years before his death in 1864, he had the satisfaction of seeing his ships carrying ice to 53 ports all over the world. The last glimpse we have of the Ice King is at 80, as he stands at a frosted window in the cold he so despised, watching the weather and remarking,
"The frost covers the window. The wheels creak. The boys run. Winter rules. And $50,000 worth of ice floats for me on fresh pond. Ice to cool the palates of the world, that I might be warm."
world has come far since the days of Frederick Tudor and his shiploads of ice. And in no respect has it progressed further than in the science of refrigeration. Today, modern electric refrigeration and ice-making methods have long since made Tudor's enterprise out of date. But his discovery of better insulation to protect his ice helped push forward the day when the ice itself would be unnecessary. An unusual result, indeed, to Frederick Tudor's equally strange adventure in research. And that's today's Adventures in Research, produced in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories.
Adventures in Research, on Tuned to Yesterday from the middle 1940s, that was a syndicated broadcast. You're listening to an hour of true history. On Tuned to Yesterday, I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for the Cavalcade of America broadcast called The Red Death, which tells us the story of the malady pellagra. This episode from October 30th, 1940, has a wealth of radio stars, including Edwin Jerome, Agnes Moorehead, and Ray Collins. Also an actor who just 3 days earlier than this episode had played the Shadow on radio, William Johnstone, who plays an uncredited role. This first heard on the NBC Red Network on October 30th, 1940.
The Cavalcade of America, presented by DuPont, makers of better things for better living through chemistry. Tonight, the Cavalcade of America presents Red Death, the story of Dr. Joseph Goldberger and his fight against pellagra. Our star from the Cavalcade players is Edwin Jerome. The part of Dr. Horn is played by Ray Collins, Granny by Jeanette Nolan, Mary Goldberger by Agnes Moorehead, Elmer by Elliot Reed, and the Governor by John McIntyre. Our orchestra and original musical score are under the direction of Don Voorhees. DuPont, makers of better things for better living through chemistry, present Red Death on the Cavalcade of America.
The year 1915. The hills and fields of America's Southland are lush and green, and the land is peaceful and good. The Gulf Coast is a blue curve against the high surf, and the rich sun slants through the canebrakes of the valley of the Mississippi. But stalking the Carolina hills, striding sure-footed across the copper earth of Georgia, through the Black Belt and beyond, is death. No man sees him. No man knows the time of his coming, for the cropper's hoe will fall to the earth, and the man bend double with the agony inside him. And all men know it, and the sure death it brings, and the brand of doom it leaves on the faces of its victims. The mark of the Red Death.
Granny, I guess there's nothing more I can do here now.
Dead. Sam's dead. They're all gone now. All my boys.
It's hard, I know. It's hard for all of us, Granny.
Cotton's going to rot here this year. Same as down to the Bennetts last year when the misery took the old man away. Ain't this never gonna let up, Doctor?
All we can do is hope and pray, Granny.
Hope? Pray? What else I've been doing, Doctor?
I know, Granny, but maybe something will come of it. They say a big scientist is coming down here to find what this sickness is.
I know what it is. It's a curse of the devil on poor folks.
Granny, sometimes it seems like that's just what it is. But there must be a reason why, and maybe this man can help us. You see, he'll have laboratories and ways of finding things out.
Maybe so. But that won't bring my boys back. Nothing will bring them back to me.
I heard you were coming, Dr. Goldberger, and I want to be the first to meet you and the missus.
Well, that's very kind of you, Dr. Horn.
Now, if there's anything I can do, you just have to ask me.
Well, we really ought to find a good boarding house someplace.
Oh, no, no. You'll do no such thing, ma'am. I want you to put up at my house till you're settled.
Oh, Dr. Horn, we wouldn't think of putting you to that trouble.
Why, it'd be no trouble at all, ma'am. Besides, it'll give us a chance to get acquainted before we get the doctor in office for his laboratory.
I have no laboratory, Dr. Horn.
You mean, you didn't bring any equipment with you on the train?
No. I mean, I'm not going to have a laboratory. That is, what you think of as one.
Oh. Well, we've all done just about everything we can think of, but it's no use. I'm afraid you're going to find out it's like, trying to trap a ghost.
I'll tell you, Dr. Horn. You asked me about a laboratory. These hills are my laboratory. I believe we'll never know anything about Pellagra until we know these people, their habits, the way they live. I want to do that first.
Well, seems to me that's putting the cart before the horse. Not a thing about them I couldn't tell you right off. Why, if you'd just go over my case history...
No. Thank you, Dr. Horn, but I don't think case histories will help. I believe the answer to this is the living. It's the lives these people live that must be studied, not the deaths they die.
Whoa there. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Howdy, mister.
How do you do?
You looking for someone hereabouts?
No. No, I'm a stranger here. I thought I'd have a look around.
Well, don't you go near that cabin over there. They got the misery there.
Oh.
Bad.
Friends of yours?
Yeah, they was. I don't go there no more. They're bad luck, those folks. They don't have nothing but bad luck. Yeah. And it seems like the poorer they get, the sicker they get.
Oh. Isn't anyone looking after them?
Yeah, they can't afford no doctor. We can send over what we can to eat, but... we ain't got much ourselves.
Maybe I could help them. I'm a doctor.
You? You don't look like no doctor.
Well, I'm a special kind.
Yeah, I sure hope you can fix up them folks over there.
I'll do what I can.
Yeah. Say, Doc.
Yes?
Now, look, I don't want you to get the idea I got the misery. Because I ain't sick, mind you. It's just... well, I ain't feeling so good.
Let me look at the side of your face there. Seems to have a mark.
What? Oh, there. Oh, that's sunburn. I get that every year come spring.
You get it in the spring, eh?
Sure. Skin gets dry like from the sun. Like these here cracks between the knuckles. It don't hurt none.
Let me see your hands. I see.
Well, they don't hurt none, Doc. It's like I'm so tired all the time. And there's a kind of a raw feeling in my stomach sometimes. So I can't hardly eat.
You sleep well?
Tolerable. I don't hanker for too much sleep. I get bad dreams.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the doctor used to give a tonic-like to the granny woman. Fixed her right up.
Put her to sleep, you mean?
Yeah. Hey, Doc, you don't think I've got it?
We don't know much about this sickness, lad. It may take us quite a while to find out what's causing it.
Doc, you don't think I'm getting it, do you? Do you?
Yes, son, I do. I'm afraid you've got it.
Mild-mannered, quiet-spoken doctor, following on the heels of the phantom Red Death.
doing what he can along the way to help and comfort its victims. But the phantom itself is always just ahead of him, invincible and deadly. He quarantines houses. The Red Death walks silently in past the guards. He isolates whole communities. The Red Death strikes as before. Once, he thinks he's trapped it. Yet he's only touched its shadow. But on he plods.
There, it's finished.
Thank you, dear. Looks very neat and impressive, doesn't it?
The Etiology of Pellagra by Joseph Goldberger. Sounds so scientific some way or other. Not like tramping along country roads and talking to all those people. Not like you, Joseph.
It has to be complicated, or our friends on the commission wouldn't be able to understand it.
Joseph, it's amazing when you think men have worked on this problem for so long, and the answer was as simple as this.
You're right, Mary. It is simple. Just a matter of balanced diet. Of educating people against a restricted one of cornmeal, molasses, and side pork all the time. Do that, and you'll end pellagra.
I wish I could be at the meeting to hear you.
I wish you could too, Mary. Huh? I think we've proved our case.
That you, Joseph?
Yes, Mary.
You've been gone so long.
I had an errand at the hospital.
Joseph, what about the meeting, your report?
They laughed at me.
Oh, no, they couldn't.
They insisted, in spite of all our evidence to the contrary, that a germ is causing pellagra. Why, one jackass there...
Joseph!
Well, he was a jackass, and I told him so to his face.
I've never seen you angry like this before.
Well, I am angry. An epidemic like typhoid, he said. And they all nodded their heads. Yes, a germ causes pellagra. Well, if it's laboratory work they want, they'll get it. I went down to the hospital this evening and got enough blood serum from pellagra victims to wipe out an army if pellagra were contagious.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to inject it into my own veins, my muscles, my spine. I'm going to drink it. I'm going to smear it on my skin.
I know how you feel, dear. Joseph.
Yes.
I'm going to take the injections with you.
Mary.
Two subjects for experiment would carry more weight than one.
That has nothing to do with it.
Joseph, you and I have always been together. We've believed together. Shouldn't it be that way now?
Mary, please, I...
There's some hypodermics here. Here's the alcohol and cotton. All right. I'm waiting. Please, Joseph.
Very well, Mary.
There. Now it's you. Roll up your sleeve, dear.
Yes. There. All right. If they want this kind of proof, we'll give it to them. Governor Brewer, I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you.
It's all right, Dr. Goldberger. Heard a lot about you. Did some work with Walter Reed in yellow fever, didn't you?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That was a great experience. Governor, I am here to ask you a favor.
Sure, ma'am. Go ahead. What is it?
I'd like to go into the state penitentiary.
Well, there are a lot of laws you could break and get into prison, Dr. Goldberger.
Oh, no, I want to conduct an experiment.
What kind of an experiment?
Governor, I want to experiment with a group of convicts and induce pellagra.
What?
Let me explain. Governor, I am convinced pellagra is caused by the wrong kind of food. Not enough variety. Balance the diet and you will prevent pellagra.
I always heard it was caused by a germ.
I know better. My wife and I injected ourselves with blood serum taken from dying pellagra victims. We did not contract it. I think that disposes of the germ theory.
Well, it doesn't prove a balanced diet will stop it.
Right here in Jackson, Governor Brewer... I investigated pellagra cases in an orphanage. I found out that children between 6 and 12 were fed on the typical poor families rations of cornmeal and molasses. And most of them had pellagra.
Yes, I know about that.
Then you ought to know about this, sir. Those that didn't have pellagra told me they were stealing milk and meat and vegetables on the sly. They meant they were getting a balanced diet. They warded off the disease that way.
Understand me, Dr. Goldberger. If I can help you get rid of this infernal disease, I'll do it. Now, if I let you go over to the prison, what would be your procedure?
I will feed those convicts the average poor family's diet, and they will develop pellagra.
But what if one of them dies? They'd call it cold-blooded murder.
Those men won't die. I'll put them back on a balanced diet, and that will cure them.
You're sure you can?
Yes, Governor, I am.
Then go ahead. I'll phone the warden to pick out 12 men for you, and you can give them your proposition.
Thank you, Governor.
And Goldberger, tell them this. If they're willing to take the risk, after it's over, I'll pardon each one.
Governor Brewer, for this you will have the gratitude of science and all humanity.
All right, boys, line up. Men, this is Dr. Goldberger. He's gotten something to say to you.
Thank you, Warden. Men, I'll give you the good news first. If you will do what is asked, the governor will give each of you a pardon.
Pardon? Well, doctor, sir, is you sure there ain't a catch in this somewhere?
Yes, there is a catch in it. You will have to do just as I tell you. You will live in the new bunkhouse, away from all the other prisoners. You will get plenty to eat. You can stuff yourselves. I want you to. But all you will get will be cornbread, molasses, grits, side pork, and a few other things.
Well, what are we waiting for?
Not so fast. I still haven't come to the catch, and here it is. It is very possible that you will all contract a disease. Pellagra.
Excuse me, doctor, sir, but I know what that misery is. I seen my little sister die of it. Why, you want to give anybody that kind of misery?
Because if you men do contract pellagra, the world will know how to cure others who have it. We can drive it off the face of the earth.
I ain't going to get that misery for nobody.
No, I don't want to.
Oh, shut up. What? You all want to get out of here, don't you? Maybe we won't catch it nohow.
Yeah, it's worth a chance.
Sure it is. I'll go, doctor.
Me too.
Yeah, I'll go.
Doctor, is you sure you can cure us up again if we catch it?
I am sure.
And then we really get to all the side pork and cornbread what we can eat?
That's right.
Then I's with you too, Doctor. And you can tell the governor he can start getting ready with them pardons.
All right. You may go now.
I'm on my way, Doc.
Bring in 3216, Doctor.
3216, come on in. The doctor's ready for you.
Well, how are you feeling today?
Never felt better.
You sleep all right?
Yeah, like a top.
No pain anywhere?
Nope.
No marks on him anywhere, Dr. Goldberger.
All right, you may go.
Thanks.
I don't understand it. All this time and still not one case has developed. I've observed thousands of cases developing and primary symptoms should have appeared by now.
There's still a man waiting outside. You want to examine him?
Yes, we must complete the record.
I'll call him in.
1430.
Yes, sir.
You're next.
Yes, sir. I'm sure as glad you all decided to see me. It's near time for mess over to the bunkhouse, and I's hungry.
I see. Your appetite is all right, I take it.
Oh, yes, sir. Boy, does I feel good.
Any sign, doctor?
Not a single mark.
Well, that settles it. I must be wrong. And I don't see how I can be. Well, this finishes me. Yes, Warden?
You finished with this man?
Yes. We're finished with all of them. The experiment has failed.
Dr. Goldberger, sir?
Yes.
If you all's leaving, I just want to thank you before you go. The pardon and all that fine food. I appreciate it. Yes,
oh,
indeed
that,
I do.
That's all right.
And most especially that fine steak dinner.
Steak dinner? Warden, what's this about a steak dinner?
Well, sir, they was complaining like about the same grub, doctor. Well, it being a holiday, I figured it wouldn't do them no harm.
No harm? No wonder the experiment hasn't proved my point by now.
I didn't aim to interfere with your experiment. I just
can't you understand what you've done? You've very nearly destroyed the one chance of finding the cause of pellagra. From now on, Wharton, these men stick to the meals I prescribe. Is that clear?
Yes, sir. Yes, it won't happen again, sir.
I tell you, Doc, I'm getting so I can't even stand the smell of cornbread no more. Let's call it off and skip your supper tonight.
Well, we'd better look you all over again. Number 3216.
I'm feeling okay, Doc.
You're sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, maybe I ate too much.
No signs, Dr. Goldberger.
Next, 1430.
I can't stand it no more. Doc, I sure got the misery.
Quick, examine this man, Doc.
My insides, Doc, my insides. You gotta tell me, is I got that misery?
Dr. Goldberger, look here, behind his ear.
That's it. Pellagra. At last, we proved it.
Well, they can't laugh this time, Doctor. This means the end of pellagra.
No. This is only the beginning of the end. We've trapped our enemy. But we must defeat his allies. Poverty and ignorance. And when we vanquish them, we will have finally vanquished pellagra.
Red mark. For years, its ban meant death. But to a quiet, bespectacled doctor standing in a bunkhouse of a Mississippi state prison, it meant the climax of a long struggle. A struggle he has handed on to valiant men and women who today carry out his ideas, thus giving new hope to humanity. Through education, pellagra may well be vanquished in our lifetime. And for his ceaseless labor for the betterment of the human race, Dr. Joseph Goldberger joins the immortals in the cavalcade of America.
Cavalcade of America thanks Edwin Jerome and the Cavalcade Players for their performance of Red Death. And now the DuPont Company brings you its story from the wonder world of chemistry.
In the Valley of the Kanawha in West Virginia is a DuPont plant that extends for the better part of a mile along a river. One of the things it makes is common, ordinary chemical fertilizer for our farms. Common? Ordinary? Let's see. The plows of the pioneers were iron, pointed, sharp, and they gouged the land. West, the plow furrows ran toward the setting sun. Behind lay the land, scarred, exhausted. The land lay starving because men forgot their children would live after them. We have learned at last to feed the fields that feed us. We have learned that the land rewards us if we replenish the elements we take away from it. That even poor land becomes fertile if we give it food. It took a while to learn the lesson, and we paid in the learning. But we know it by heart now. Forget not the land, or the land will forget. That it may feed us, the land must be fed. Fed how? Fed with what? In West Virginia, there is a valley. Necklaces of coal lie high in the hills there, so that men must mine up to it, not down. Airplanes passing over look down on still another necklace, a circlet of silvery pipe. Through the pipes now gas flows silently. Gas from coal, gas from water, gas from air, born in flaming steam, Gas from black diamonds under the land. Gas from water that rolls over the land. Gas from the high, clear air. The gases meet in the dark cauldron of an autoclave. No man could live there. The pressure is 6 tons to every inch, enough to smash a diamond to dull dust. And heat, heat so great that a penny tossed into it becomes a drop of molten copper. 2,400 degrees, raging, thundering, driven by pressure and heat to lock arms in new substances, the gases race. And down from reaction chambers lined with glistening silver, down from whirling centrifuges, tumbles a soft, incredible snowfall of white crystals, like stars. Flakes made not by snow clouds, but by man, sifting down and down. Stranger than snow crystals, for within their delicate filigree is a precious food that must go to the land, if the land is to live. This is the essence of Uraman. Uraman, with its precious nitrogen for America's fields, for the hungry section, the quarter sections, the 40s, the 12s. Out it goes to all the counties with names from all the languages. Rustook and Kent and San Jacinto, Fernando and Saline and Coos and Rio Arriba, Elk, Galea, Wyandotte and Hickory. The counties of the land we cherish. In Uraman are the potatoes a little boy will eat for supper this winter. The orange juice a little girl will drink for breakfast next spring. These are the crystals of life itself, body and bone and brain of America's tomorrow, bestowed upon fields with their blessing by chemists faithful to the DuPont pledge. Better things for better living through chemistry.
The Cavalcade of America, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 30th of October, 1940, on the NBC Red Network, bringing to a close this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. And until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. It's been a pleasure.